Hello, and welcome to the Lies.com podcast for Friday, February 9th. I apologize for the long gap in my posting and podcasting schedule. I actually recorded a podcast last Friday, but wasn't happy with it. The content was weak, the technical quality was weak, and when you came right down to it, I just decided to scrap it. So it will remain the elusive lost podcast for future generations of obsessive collectors of Lies.com memorabilia. I'll try and talk about the high points of what I covered in that podcast so you'll actually have anything worthwhile that you might have missed. I spent all of that podcast talking about my addiction to Halo, the computer game, and explaining what it was that was so compelling about it for me, and trying to answer the question of why a grown man would spend hour after hour staying up all night playing a game against obnoxious 12-year-olds. And I ended up being sidetracked into basically talking about all these specific aspects of the game that, you know, if you're someone who plays the game, might be interesting. If you're not, I tend to think would not be. So I'm going to skip most of that this time. Halo, if you're not familiar with it, though, is a first-person shooter. It's getting a little long in the tooth at this point. Halo 2 is actually out on the Xbox, but I don't play it on the Xbox. I don't own an Xbox. I have the Mac version of Halo 1, or the original Halo. And there's two basic modes in which you can play the game. There's campaign mode, where you're playing against the computer, shooting up aliens as you go through this whole sort of movie-like storyline. And again, forgive me if I'm explaining things that you already are perfectly well aware of. I think if someone's geeky enough to be listening to the Lies.com podcast, they're probably geeky enough to have a first-hand acquaintance with first-person shooters and how they tend to play out. Or they're someone who's completely disinterested in the subject matter, in which case, again, I'm off-base to even be describing it. But I've never let that stop me before. So you have this campaign mode in which you fight against aliens, the Covenant, and then later on in the game, in a pretty cool plot twist, they introduce this different batch of enemies, the Flood. And the thing that's cool about that is that in fighting the Covenant, you know, you figure out these strategies and tactics that work against them. And typically, by the time you're, you know, halfway, two-thirds of the way through the game, you're pretty good at fighting Covenant. You know that they tend to hold their position, so as you're coming upon them, you approach them cautiously, and when you see them, you hang back and snipe at them from a distance with your pistol. And then, you know, only once you've cleaned them out do you go forward. If you get behind in the fight and your shields are down or you're losing health, you know, again, you retreat, you find a quiet spot to hole up and regenerate, and then you come back more carefully. So you've got these techniques down, and they're basically to the point of being a habit that you don't even question, and then you come upon the Flood. And it really is pretty cool, the whole setup they have, the sort of ominous hints they give you as you get closer and closer to where the Flood finally start coming after you. And what the Flood are is they're this sort of infectious alien that, like a virus that takes over humans and kills them and then reanimates their bodies as zombies, or Covenant forces also, the big reptilian people you've been fighting up till now, they can also become infected by the Flood and turn into these zombies. And the thing about the zombies is they basically have the opposite. They basically penalize the tactics that work so well against the Covenant. So whereas the Covenant would tend to hold their position and attack you, and if you retreated, they stayed there, the Covenant just come after you. And they're fairly fast, and they just keep coming. Things like sniping them at a distance really doesn't work. And in fact, the weapon that until then you've learned to regard as pretty much useless, the assault rifle, sort of the standard issue Marines weapon that you start off the game with. You start off with the pistol, but the assault rifle that is sort of the most common weapon in the game, you've learned to completely disdain it because it's not much use against the Covenant except in certain circumstances. Now suddenly the assault rifle is the weapon of choice, you know, and the Covenant weapons that you've learned to sort of glean on the battlefield and use quite effectively against the Covenant shields, those are essentially useless against the Flood. So you get the assault rifle now, and it's really useful. And then, of course, there's the shotgun, which they introduce around this point in the game. And the shotgun rules for battling the Covenant. I mean, excuse me, for battling the Flood. And you need these new tactics that you basically, when the Flood come after you, you just retreat constantly and blast them. And, you know, you can go around a corner and take up a position there and then get them one at a time as they round the corner coming after you. You learn this trick that, you know, even once you've shot it and put it down, a Flood enemy doesn't necessarily stay down. They'll reanimate themselves and come after you again. So I wanted to pump a few extra rounds into them. It's really kind of gruesome, this whole part of the game, but it's fun. So that's the campaign mode. And at the end, you know, you finally win the game. And then you play the game again on a harder setting, and there's like four, I think, settings or so, ending with the legendary setting where there's just tons of enemies and not so much equipment on your side, and you really have to be careful. But with the help of a walkthrough and some, you know, good advice from other obsessives, I have, like most people who play the game, I eventually did finish the whole game on legendary, and it was fun. But I don't think my addiction would have continued to this point. Well, I'm sure my addiction would not have continued to this point if the game just had the campaign mode, because in fact I hardly play that these days. There is another mode, the multiplayer mode, where you basically connect to an internet server and play against other humans. And for me, that's just a whole order of magnitude more compelling. As good as the AI in the original Halo was, and it was pretty good in terms of alien tactics and you know, sort of the artificial intelligence that determines the aliens' behaviors, they're really nothing compared to actual human opponents. And, you know, I find that the most memorable things for me about playing multiplayer Halo is not so much the actual competition and the winning and losing. It's the little interactions you have with others. You can type in a text message, you know, a taunt. You can enter, like, I don't know, it's like 50 characters or something, and send it. And you can either type that message to everybody who's in the game, the 4 or 8 or 16 players who are currently playing, however many there are. Or you can send it just to the members of your team, if you're playing a team variation, as opposed to a every man for himself kind of game. Or you can send it to every person in your vehicle. If you're in a Warthog, the Jeep analog vehicle in, it's one of the vehicles in Halo, or I guess in a Scorpion, the big tank, you could have multiple players in there too. And so you can send a message that only goes to members of your vehicle. So actually that messaging is one of the more fun and interesting parts of the game for me. And, you know, it's certain things certainly reappear constantly as themes. When you die, you know, typing in this text message, you know, while you're doing this, you're basically standing there not moving, because normally you're using your typing and keyboarding skills to, you know, to take the actions that move you through the game. So when you're typing in at the keyboard, when you're typing your taunt, you're not doing that. You're just standing there like an idiot. And, you know, it's a popular way to get killed. Here, I'll let this completely obnoxious little red sports car go on by me. He's like 5 feet off my rear bumper. You know, so you tend not to send those messages during the normal play unless it's important. But you can also do it when you get killed. There's a respawn time. You know, unlike reality, after you get killed in Halo, you typically come back and get to continue playing. But there's a interval of time during which you're waiting to respawn, and that's a popular time in which to send messages, typically, you know, questioning the morality of the person who just killed you. Common complaint is that the person who killed you is a noob. Noob is the probably most popular taunt in multiplayer Halo. It, of course, means you're a newbie, you're a new player. And if you kill someone with a relatively powerful weapon, you know, a rocket launcher or a plasma cannon, you're almost certain to get characterized as a noob by your victim. But it's a hollow claim, since you're alive and he's dead. There's also, you know, there's different characters that games take based on the kinds of interactions people have with each other. There's some where you really do have a bunch of 12-year-olds who are operating at and I'm not ragging on 12-year-olds per se, but I'm just sort of characterizing the level of maturity you find in some games where, you know, people really do are just are in there using foul language and you know, stuff that only a 12-year-old could love. There's other games where actually people are having a good time and are complimentary of each other or making funny comments about each other. And, you know, those tend to be the games I enjoy a lot more. And you see some funny things in Halo. I can remember one time, you know, one of the really frustrating things about getting better at Halo and playing in a multiplayer mode is that you then have to contend with teammates who are not as good as you. And in certain games, especially, say, Capture the Flag, which is probably the second most popular multiplayer game after Slayer, Capture the Flag is all about strategy. You know, if you can work effectively as a team, you can own the other team, or pwn the other team in leetspeak, P-W-N, another favorite word to show in your taunt. You know, you can pause after killing somebody or after, you know, being killed yourself and sort of acknowledge, you know, pwned, to indicate that, yes, you were completely outclassed in that confrontation. But you'll get totally owned in Halo if you're, in a team capture the flag game and your team is not actually playing as a team, if you're not cooperating, you know, if you're not coordinating your activities with each other effectively. And so, you know, as a player who's a little more experienced and playing against players who are not, or playing with players on your team who are not as experienced, it can be a real pain to, you know, you're trying to get them to actually contribute to the team, and they're off on their individual things. That's kind of part of the fun, too, of playing a game like this. You can do what you want. You know, there's no way to compel somebody to behave differently. But if you're, you know, on a team game, especially a strategy-heavy game like Capture the Flag, and you're not employing effective group strategy, you're just going to lose. And sometimes you'll actually have stuff, you'll be dealing with players actually attacking their own teammates. And this gets into, you know, griefing and the kinds of antisocial behavior that are rampant in online multiplayer games. There's a certain class of player for whom it's more interesting and fun. They can provoke the reaction that they're looking for more effectively by attacking their own teammates than by trying to beat the other team. You know, you have a certain advantage. If you're just looking to provoke angry responses, it is significantly more efficient to do it by attacking your own team, since they're not expecting it, you know, so they don't kill you first. And this leads to some really insane feuds among a team. And at one point, Bungie, the software company, or I'm not sure if it's Bungie Maxsoft, I'm not sure who it is, but whoever puts out the Mac version or the PC/Mac version of Halo, they introduced some new features at one point that made this much easier to deal with. Things like an default auto ban. If you kill your teammates like 3 times or 5 times, you'll be automatically kicked out of the game. And features like that made the game much more enjoyable. If you were playing multiplayer Halo in the days before that feature was introduced, it was really hit or miss. Probably half the games out there would eventually become just taken over by these huge TK fests, team killing fests, where you're killing your own teammates and people getting really pissed off at each other and screaming at each other, and, you know, there's not much you can do. And for a certain kind of griefer, as they're called, the fact that everybody's yelling at them is an incentive, you know, so it really just devolved into a ridiculous waste of time. But it's not so bad these days. But one game I do remember in particular, just because it cracked me up, it was a 3-on-3 game of Capture the Flag in Blood Gulch, which in some ways I would view as the purest form of multiplayer Halo. That's a game configuration that I would play pretty much any opportunity I had, because it really does give you a lot of room. It doesn't matter why I like it. I really like that particular game configuration. I think is really enjoyable. So I'm on this team with 2 other guys, and, you know, trying to get them organized, trying to get them, focused on winning. And they end up, you know, getting into it with each other. One of them kills the other one, and the other one kills him back, and they're just going at it with each other, and I can't convince them to stop. And, you know, I'm seeing any hopes of our winning this game just go down the drain, because it's basically come down to me against the 3 players on the other team. So I'm running around and following these 2 players of mine on my team, trying to get them to see reason and talking to them about what they're doing, and they're just ignoring it. They're just so, you know, consumed with battle lust as they go after each other. And the funniest thing I think I've ever seen in Halo is they're both trying to kill each other, and they aren't very adept players, so they're actually failing to kill each other as they go back and forth. They're standing next to each other, and I'm not sure whether they're, like, using plasma pistols on each other, and I don't know. One of them eventually jumps in a warthog. There's a chain gun warthog that's standing there, a warthog with the big machine gun mounted in the back. He jumps in the warthog, and the other one also jumps in the warthog, jumps up on the chain gun, and tries to shoot his driver, which, if you've played the game, is technically impossible to do. When you're in the back of a warthog, it's, you know, the way it's implemented is the gun will not fire on anyone in the vehicle. So he's shooting at his driver. The driver drives off, and they scream off across the Blood Gulch landscape with the gunner plowing this furrow of you know, in front of the vehicle as he's desperately trying to depress the gun far enough to shoot his own driver. And at that point, I just realized that these two were a lost cause, and I just left the game. But when you do get a good team, you know, a team that's really playing well, and especially a team that's playing well together, it can be a great experience, and you can dominate the competition. Although, I have to say, you know, I've gotten to the point now where on my preferred maps and my preferred games, I'm to the point where I can be pretty confident of finishing near the top of the individual rankings in any multiplayer Halo game I'm playing most of the time. You know, there's the occasional bad luck or just, you know, a better opponent that'll cause you to have a string of events that puts you down at the bottom. But usually I can either come in first or second or, you know, third. I'm really partial to race games. I'll put myself up against pretty much anyone racing a warthog. If we have equal ping times, that is, if our connection to the server is such that we're getting an equally responsive game experience, I'll take you on. I'll take you on in a warthog race on any Halo map. With pretty good confidence that I'm going to win. I mean, there are a few racers out there, people who tend to play race games in Halo that I know are better than I am. You know, I can think of two or three of them. But average run-of-the-mill Halo player, I'm a pretty good racer. And capture the flag, you know, I'm good at. Slayer, I can do okay in Slayer, depending on who I'm playing against. This is where you're just trying to kill each other. You know, there really are two distinct aspects of success in multiplayer Halo. One is strategy, is knowing the maps, knowing the games, knowing how to work together with other people. And there I think I've really got a strong edge over most of the people I compete against. The other is just sort of, you know, hand-eye coordination, aiming and shooting and reaction time. And there, you know, there are definitely people who are better than I am, and I encounter them with regularity. You know, one common complaint when someone's dead is he'll claim that the person who killed him is cheating. He'll claim that he's using an aim bot, you know, a piece of software that basically takes all the challenge out of the game and just automatically gives you a perfect shot on any opponent anytime you fire your weapon. And while I have definitely seen examples of that in playing the game, I think it's far less common than most of the noobs complaining would have you believe. Most of the time, it's just that the person who killed you is a whole lot better than you are. And you can see that. I mean, the person who's really good at the game is not going to bother using an aimbot. The person who's going to use an aimbot is someone who's not that good, but who, for whatever reason, you know, really, really wants to win at any cost and is willing to cheat to do it. So when you see someone who's much, much better than you are and is killing you every time, you know, you look at the rest of their game. I mean, are they playing intelligently? Are they putting themselves in the right position to have an advantage over you? Are they getting the right weapon and using it effectively? Or are they just kind of blundering around killing you every time they see you? And, you know, in the former case, no, it's not an aimbot. It's just someone who's much better than you are. On that same note, and then I'll leave the Halo discussion or else it'll end up consuming the whole podcast like it did last time. One thing I definitely do encounter is, you know, when you play, you know, yes, you find that there are people who you can, if you've played for a while, yes, there are people you can definitely beat, and there are people that I can go in and just dominate. But there are other people who will dominate me still, and I've been playing obsessively for years now. And these, you know, there tend to be a couple things. One is just the player is just insanely good, and there are some out there like that. These are people who, you know, not only know all the strategy and tactics, but they're actually playing it enough. You know, these people are probably, they're in effect, they're athletes in training. I mean, except that they're probably, you know, a quivering lump of goo on a sofa somewhere. But they're basically playing the game hours and hours a day, you know, maybe 8 hours a day, and just really honing those those skills. And, you know, those people are impressive. The other thing that will reliably lead to a frustrating experience is playing against a team of people that are using voice communications, that are using like TeamSpeak or one of these applications that let them chat together, or they're all in the same room. You know, they're at a LAN party or something, and they're all actually talking to each other while they're playing. And because this gives you such a big increase in your communications bandwidth over typing to each other, people who you can tell. I mean, you can really tell when you're playing against a team that's coordinated that way, because if they are and you aren't, there's pretty much no way to beat them in a game like Capture the Flag. You know, it really ends up, it's like watching basketball. You know, a team that plays effectively as a team in basketball can completely dominate a team with one or two superstars but no real effective sense of team play. The Lakers certainly saw that, you know, in the recent NBA Finals. So, but it's educational and it's certainly challenging. And there is the occasional time. I remember one game where I was playing against a team that was really, you know, they're all in the same guild. They have their guild ID and their names, and you could tell these are people who practice together a lot, and they're obviously communicating together. And I was playing a string of Capture the Flag games on their server with sort of this motley pickup team of, you know, random people coming along playing against them, getting their butts kicked game after game after game. But as we played, you know, I'm a competitive guy, and I'm a good Capture the Flag player, and I was chatting it up in the, you know, in the typing channel, talking to the people on my team and coordinating them and learning who was on the team. And there were three or four other guys. This was 8-on-8, I think, or 6-on-6. I mean, it was a big game. But there were three or four other guys who were pretty good, who were, you know, hanging with me, and we were getting to know each other and you know, chatting it up back and forth a lot, and getting to where we were getting more and more effective. And, you know, I think we played three or four games, and the first several, you know, we lost dismally. But then the next one after that, we actually were pretty close. You know, we actually gave them a hard time. They didn't just come in and dominate us. We scored a few times, and we kept them from winning the game. I think we actually played until the game timed out, which must have been pretty frustrating on their part, since they'd been dominating us so thoroughly up till then. And then came this game that I'll always remember. The game site was cycling from one map to another, most all the different big maps. And it cycled to the Infinity map. It's one of the biggest maps in Halo, maybe the biggest, I'm not sure. And, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. It's a big map. And we started playing, and, you know, two or three of our guys went for the flag, and one of them got lucky and scored. And we actually got a lead. And meanwhile, I was hanging back defending our flag, or camping, as it is pejoratively called by those who consider it something along with using those heavy weapons as a noobish offense. But hey, you know, we were in no position to play by Queensbury rules in this case. We were doing whatever we could to win, and they were, you know, they were doing the same. It wasn't like we were being unfair in my hanging out the base. But I was hanging out and got some good grenade throws that took out a couple of their attempts on taking our flag, and in one of those I ended up with a heavy weapon, you know, a plasma cannon I think they'd left behind, and then I was in good shape, you know, set myself up and kind of hung out and used all those special Halo skills I've honed over the years, you know, using your ears to tell where they're coming from, and, you know, good timing, and, you know, kind of knowing what they're going to do and being in the place to thwart it so that they don't, you know, they don't succeed in doing it. And we got another score at one point, and then they got a score, and we were playing to 3. So, you know, it was 2-on-1, we were winning, and one of our players, I'm not sure, I don't remember if we ended up timing out or if we actually scored a third time. I think we timed out, we won the game 2-1. At the end of the game, they were just, you know, because they were behind, and they're, you know, as the game's kind of down, they had like, you know, 2 minutes left, 1 minute left. They were just going for an all-out assault. And it was fun to see their desperation. It was fun to see them, you know, doing everything they could. And, you know, we hung back at that point and just started playing heavy defense. And we won that game. And it was one of the most satisfying victories I think I've ever had in a Halo game. And couldn't help doing a bit of taunting after the game was over. We cycled into the next game. And I commented, you know, something about just how enjoyable it was. And immediately got banned. You know, their server operator had enough of hearing me crowing about that even from the first word. But that even made it more satisfying. So I was so excited talking about this, I got off at the wrong off-ramp. I got off one street early, so I'm going to have to pop off Rose and go over to Rice here. But so much for Halo. I want to talk about a few other things in this podcast besides just Halo. Anyway, I am Private Donut. My name is Private Donut, and I am a Halo addict. And, you know, I'm going to try and... I'll probably not play Halo this weekend. I've got a lot of things going on that I should be doing other than playing a silly game with 12-year-olds. So I think I'll let my Halo addiction lie fallow for a while and recuperate. There's been a lot of stuff in the news about Bush and the domestic spying program. And I don't know. I just can't bring myself to even pay much attention or care. You know, at this point, if you're still giving the Bush administration the benefit of the doubt, if you're still willing to take them, you know, basically saying of this program, well, trust us, you know, we're not going to take this legal argument that says the president can basically do whatever he wants in a time of war, a war that has no, you know, specific end point in sight. And with that, that's basically what they've argued, is that, well, you know, we have to set the Constitution aside and basically have a dictatorship. And if we're just counting on the good graces and the sense of adherence to democratic principles that resides inside George Bush's head, if we're just relying on that as the only wall between tyranny and democracy in this country, then I think we're in big, big trouble. But we'll see. We'll see where that goes. I've been watching a bunch of movies lately. I went with Linda to see Brokeback Mountain, which I thought was a great movie. You know, I wanted it to have a happier ending, but I was certainly pulled into the experience of those characters and enjoyed watching it. Heath Ledger was fantastic as the, you know, just so, he was so quiet in the movie. I mean, he rarely spoke, and the few times when he did have an outburst was really powerful as a result. And I really enjoyed Ang Lee's direction in the movie. It reminded me so much of his direction in Sense and Sensibility, where, I mean, he has these beautiful vistas, these beautiful landscape shots, these exterior shots. But he also can do amazing things with his interior shots. You know, he'll, just the way the set and the way he photographs it, putting people in these environments that are so, they communicate so much. You know, I think of the scene in Sense and Sensibility where the Dashwoods first go to the cottage, you know, where they go to their cousin or whatever he is, Sir John, what is it, Middleton? I'm not sure. The person who, you know, graciously, the place they have to go stay, the sort of rundown cottage that they end up living in, you know, just as he takes you, as Ang Lee takes you inside that cottage and you're seeing it for the first time from their perspective, or as you're seeing it, you know, later on in the movie too, and you compare it with the, you know, opulent luxury of the place they're coming, that they were formerly living in, he just communicates very effectively, you know, this change in their circumstances and what it means. And the same thing is going on in Brokeback Mountain, you know, as you see Heath Ledger's character or Jake Gyllenhaal's character's homes, and you see the contrast between their living conditions and, you know, with Heath Ledger's family and just the, you know, the apartment above the laundromat, and I don't know, it's just... it's very effective, I think. It's very impressive, just this, and the quietness of it too. The, you know, just sort of, again, getting back to the characters, you know, Heath Ledger's just the quietness in both movies too, in Sense and Sensibility and in Brokeback Mountain. Some of the most powerful dialogue in the movie is delivered basically at a whisper, and you have to strain to even hear what's being said, and it's just amazing stuff. It really is. You know, I think some of the scenes in Sense and Sensibility, the scene where Emma Thompson's character is communicating with Hugh Grant, is having the meeting with Hugh Grant's character to tell him about the parish that Colonel Brandon has made available to him, and just the way that scene ends, you know, with the heartbreaking sense of these two people divided by you know, events, and just the whispered leave taking, you know, Hugh Grant's just kind of, you know, Miss Dashwood. It's just very powerful. And the same sort of thing certainly appears in the same kind of, the same technique. You know, you see it several times in Brokeback Mountain. So it's a good movie. I heartily recommend it. You know, I was a little squeamish going in because of, I guess, some review had talked about the sex scenes between Jake Gyllenhaal's character and Heath Ledger's character, that it was, I don't think it said explicit, but it basically said something about how it you know, is direct and honest in its portrayal of what's going on, that it wasn't coy about it. And I wasn't sure what to expect from that. I certainly like to think I'm not homophobic, and but you know, I'm a little squeamish about on-screen intimacy of heterosexual or homosexual variety. There's certain things that, you know, just kind of make me uncomfortable watching in a movie in a theater full of people, and I don't know. It's just, I mean, sometimes it depends on how it's handled, you know. And I think I've seen it handled in ways that do make me uncomfortable enough for me to be sensitive to the question going in when I read that kind of description. But I thought it was fine. You know, the movie, I thought, was very, it was tastefully done. You know, it was just furthering the characters. And anyway, it's a good movie. You should definitely go see it. Charlotte, who cuts my hair and saw it some time ago, it's part of she's part of the Santa Barbara Film Society. I forget if that's its official name, but she's a lot of movies, you know, before they're officially out. And she had seen it and said, you know, she wasn't sure. I mean, she liked it, but she wasn't sure what all the hoopla was about. And I guess there is a certain amount of hoopla going on now with it. And I don't know. I mean, it's an important movie in the sense of, I mean, as a film to educate people about gay rights and discrimination against gays. And I think the movie is very effective as that, almost explicitly because it doesn't hit you over the head with that kind of thing. There's an indirection to how Ang Lee and the film writers, the story and the screenwriters, how they approached it, that they're not confronting you with the homophobia in the community that prevents these two characters from actually having anything like a happy life. It's there. It provides this context, this backdrop, and there are a few moments in the movie that are as powerful as anything I've seen that, you know, documents just how evil it is that you know, that basically the people who discriminate against gays and lesbians today are the moral equivalent of slaveholders of yesterday. That, you know, to take any class of person and reduce them to subhuman status and treat them, you know, so horribly. It is depicted in the movie, but it's almost so quick. I mean, the most shocking aspects of that anti-gay bias are depicted almost like before you know it, it's over. And most of the movie, it's just this sense that hangs in the background, you know, this constraint that shapes the lives of these two characters. It's very well done, and I think that's what makes it so subversive, is that it doesn't come out and beat you over the head with it. You know, a movie that was more openly advocating on behalf of gays would, I think, be easier for people to dismiss, people who are prejudiced. And, you know, I think it's a good movie because of that. I mean, I think that's a powerful aspect of the movie. It doesn't hit you over the head with that. And in contrast, I Netflixed Saving Private Ryan recently. I wanted to watch the scene again. Probably it's playing out with my Halo addiction, because that opening sequence, the storming of Normandy in that movie, is, you know, on one level, it's basically the best cinematic representation of a video game, of a first-person shooter video game that I've ever seen. And I don't know. I mean, obviously the movie is much more than that, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful of the powerful themes and subject matter that the movie does also deal with. But as in thinking about Ang Lee's sort of very restrained approach to the social message in Brokeback Mountain, I'm, you know, by contrast, I think about Steven Spielberg's approach to making a message movie, and or even not a message movie, but a movie and the messages that he chooses to put into his movies, where it's so blunt, it's so, you know, he takes such overt and obvious steps to make sure that no one, you know, not even the 12-year-olds in the audience could possibly miss the point he's making, that it completely, to me, it just completely destroys the effectiveness of the point. And I'm thinking now specifically in the bookend sequences in Saving Private Ryan at the very beginning and the very end, where you see the modern day Ryan, you know, looking back and being reduced to tears and telling me I've lived a good life. And, you know, to take nothing away from the actors in those scenes, I mean, they're doing the best they can. But Spielberg as a director is, I don't know, I mean, it just really bothers me. It just really is lame to me. It really brings the whole movie way, way down in terms of the level of artistry on display. It pulls me out of it. I think the thing that bugs me the most, and here again, you know, I hope I don't come off as an anti-Semite, because I don't believe I am, but as he pans across the graveyard at Normandy, and he makes sure that, you know, you see all these crosses, but it seems like no matter what angle he's panning from, he always, for some reason, it always happens that there's a Star of David in place of a cross. You know, there's the grave of a Jewish person there, right in the foreground. You know, and it's, he doesn't just do it once. You know, he does it at least twice. And, you know, it's like, wow, that, you know, we really had to set up those camera angles just right to make that happen, didn't we? And now, gee, there's, you know, we did it again over from this other angle. And it just really takes me out of the movie. It's like, yes, yes, Mr. Spielberg, I know. I got the point the first time, you know, and you didn't have to make such a big deal about it. And I don't know, that just bugged me a lot. So that's kind of an ugly note to characterize my review of what I think is actually a really powerful and excellent movie, and a movie that would be much more powerful and excellent if you took off the few minutes at the beginning and the end and just had it stand alone as the real movie that sits inside it. What other movies have I seen lately? I don't remember if I talked to my previous podcast. I watched Rumblefish again. You know, I was looking forward to seeing it. Wasn't sure if it would hold up and be as good a movie as I remembered it as a kid. And I did, and it was. And there were things that I had forgotten about it that I liked a lot when I saw it as a young adult. I think I first saw it when I was in my 20s. And it is a great movie. And, you know, the Stuart Copeland soundtrack I had sort of forgotten about and came to appreciate all over again. And just the cool things that Coppola did with his images in that movie and the way the story progresses and the larger aspects of the story. You know, I'm not sure if I appreciated it as much, or at least didn't remember as well as I might have, the real underlying subtext of the story, the whole motorcycle boy wanting to save his younger brother and kind of sacrificing himself in the name of saving his younger brother and getting him out of that situation. I don't know. It was a good movie. Highly recommend it if you haven't seen it. Well, there were other things I could have talked about, but as usual, I have reached Point Magoo, and I'm now into the car commercial part of my daily commute. And I guess I will conclude this week's podcast. Well, this 2 weeks podcast. This podcast is copyrighted and is distributed under a Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. I'm John Callender, and thank you very much for listening.